In the dark of night, one light still yet burns. Frightened fingers tremble as brittle pages turn. Fireside Mystery Theater presents The Midnight Reading, a special series of dramatic recitations of dark masterpieces in miniature by the masters of the macabre. Good evening, I'm Ali Silva. Now, where is it? Is it on this shelf? Or was it this one? No, I remember leaving it here. Ah, is that it? Ah, yes, that's it. Here we go. It's got quite a bit of dust on it. As you can tell, it took a little work to find this old tome in our Fireside Mystery Theater collection of old and rare books. But here it is, a lovely old edition of John Collier's splendid anthology of strange stories, Fancies and Good Nights, first published in 1951. Fancies and Good Nights is, without argument, the definitive book in which Collier's reputation still rests to this day. Let's see, I put my bookmark right here. Yes, here's the story. A dark and dusky little gem called Incident on a Lake. Here to read it for you is our own Mary Murphy.
Mr. Beasley, while shaving on the day after his 50th birthday, eyed his reflection and admitted his remarkable resemblance to a mouse.
"Cheep, cheep," he said to himself with a shrug. "What do I care? At least I wouldn't except for Maria. I remember I thought her kittenish at the time of our marriage. How she has matured."
He knotted his thread-like necktie and hurried downstairs, scared out of his life at the thought of being late for breakfast. Immediately afterwards, he had to open his drugstore, which then, in its small-town way, would keep him unprofitably busy till 10 o'clock at night. At intervals during the day, Maria would drop in to supervise, pointing out his mistakes and weaknesses, regardless of the customers. He found a brief solace every morning when, unfolding the newspaper, he turned first of all to the engaging feature originated by Mr. Ripley. On Fridays, he had a greater treat. He then received his copy of his favorite magazine, Nature Science Marvels. This reading provided, so to speak, a hole in his otherwise hopeless existence, through which he escaped from the intolerable into the incredible. On this particular morning, the incredible was kind enough to come to Mr. Beasley. It came in a long envelope, and on the handsome notepaper of a prominent law firm.
"Believe it or not, my dear," Mr. Beasley said to his wife, "but I have been left $400,000.
"Where? Let me see," cried Mrs. Beasley. "Don't hog the letter to yourself in that fashion."
"Go on," said he. "Read it. Stick your nose in it. Much good may it do you."
Oh, said she, "so you are already uppish."
"Yes," said he, picking his teeth. "I have been left $400,000.
"We shall be able," said his wife, "to have an apartment in New York or a little house in Miami."
"You may have half the money and do what you like with it," said Mr. Beasley. "For my part, I intend to travel."
Mrs. Beasley heard this remark with the consternation she always felt at the prospect of losing anything that belonged to her, however old and valueless.
"So you would desert me," she said, "to go chasing about after some native woman? I thought you were past all that."
"The only native women I am interested in," said he, "are those that Ripley had a picture of, those with lips big enough to have dinner plates set in them.
In the Nature Science Marvels magazine, they had some with necks like giraffes. I should like to see those. And pygmies, and birds of paradise, and the temples of Yucatan. I offered to give you half the money because I know you like city life and high society. I prefer to travel. If you want to, I suppose you can come along.
I will, said she. And don't forget I'm doing it for your sake, to keep you on the right path. And when you get tired of gawking and rubbering around, we'll have an apartment in New York and a little house in Miami.
So Mrs. Beasley went resentfully along, prepared to endure hell herself if she could deprive her husband of a little of his heaven. Their journeys took them into profound forests, where, from their bare bedroom, whose walls, floor, and ceiling were austerely fashioned of raw pine, they could see framed in every window a perfect little Suzanne, with a slanting light cubing bluely among the perpendiculars of pine trees, or exploding on the new green of a floating spray. In the high Andes, on the other hand, their window was a square of burning azure, with sometimes a small snow-white cloud like a tight roll of cotton in a lower corner. In the beach huts on tropical islands, they found that the tide, like an original and tasteful hotelier, deposited a little gift at their door every morning, a skeleton fan of violet seaweed, a starfish, or a shell. Mrs. Beasley, being one of the vulgar, would have preferred a bottle of Grade A and a copy of the Examiner. She sighed incessantly for an apartment in New York and a house in Miami, and she sought endlessly to punish the poor man for depriving her of them. If a bird of paradise settled on a limb above her husband's head, she was careful to let out a raucous cry and drive the interesting creature away before Mr. Beasley had time to examine it. She told him the wrong hour for the start of the trip to the temples of Yucatan, and she diverted his attention from an armadillo by pretending she had something in her eye. At the sight of a bevy of the celebrated bosoms of Bali, clustered almost like grapes upon the quay, she just turned around and went straight up the gangplank again, driving her protesting husband before her. She insisted that they should stay a long time in Buenos Aires, so that she could get a permanent wave, a facial, some smart clothes, and go to the races. Mr. Beasley humored her, for he wanted to be fair, and they took a suite in a comfortable hotel. One afternoon, when his wife was at the races, our friend struck up an acquaintance with a little Portuguese doctor in the lounge, and before long they were talking vivaciously of hoatzins, anacondas, and axolotls.
"As to that," said the little Portuguese, "I have recently returned from the headwaters of the Amazon, where the swamps and lakes are terrific. In one of those lakes, according to the Indians, there is a creature entirely unknown to science, a creature of tremendous size, something like an alligator. Something like a turtle, armor-plated, with a long neck and teeth like a saber's."
"What an interesting creature that must be," cried Mr. Beasley in a rapture.
"Yes, yes," said the Portuguese. "It is certainly interesting."
"If only I could get there," cried Mr. Beasley.
If only I could talk to those Indians. If only I could see the creature itself. Are you by any chance at liberty? Could you be persuaded to join a little expedition?
The Portuguese was willing, and soon everything was arranged. Mrs. Beasley returned from the races, and had the mortification of hearing that they were to start almost immediately for a trip up the Amazon, and a sojourn on the unknown lake in the dysgenic society of Indians. She insulted the Portuguese, who did nothing but bow, for he had an agreeable financial understanding with Mr. Beasley. Mrs. Beasley berated her husband all the way up the river, harping on the idea that there was no such creature as he sought, and that he was a credulous victim of a confidence man. Inured as he was to her usual flow of complaints, this one made him wince and humiliated him before the Portuguese. Her voice, also, was so loud and shrill that in all the thousands of miles they traveled up the celebrated river, he saw nothing but the rapidly vanishing hinder parts of tapirs, spider monkeys, and giant anteaters, which hurried to secrete themselves in the impenetrable deeps of the jungle. Finally, they arrived at the lake.
"How do we know this is the lake he was speaking of?"
Mrs. Beasley said to her husband.
"It is probably just any lake. What are those Indians saying to him? You can't understand a word. You take everything on trust. You'll never see a monster. Only a fool would believe in it."
Mr. Beasley said nothing. The Portuguese learned, from his conversation with the Indians, of an abandoned grass hut, which in due time and after considerable effort they located. They moved into it. The days passed by. Mr. Beasley crouched in the reeds with binoculars and was abominably bitten by mosquitoes. There was nothing to be seen. Mrs. Beasley succeeded in taking on a note of satisfaction, without in the least abating her tone of injury.
"I will stand this no longer," she said to her husband. "I've allowed you to drag me about. I've tried to keep my eye on you. I've traveled hundreds of miles in a canoe with natives. Now I see you wasting our money on a confidence man. We leave for Para in the morning."
"You may, if you wish," said he. "I'll write you a check for $200,000. Perhaps you can persuade some native in a passing canoe to take you down the river. But I will not come with you."
"We will see about that," said she.
She hadn't the faintest intention of leaving her husband alone, for she feared he might enjoy himself. Nevertheless, after he had written out the check and given it to her, she continued to threaten to leave him. For if he surrendered, it would be a triumph. And if he didn't, it would be another little black cross against him. She happened to rise early one morning and went out to make her ungrateful breakfast on the delicious fruits that hung in profusion all around the hut. She had not gone far before she happened to glance at the sandy ground, and there she saw a footprint that was nearly a yard wide, splayed, spurred, and clawed, and the mate to it was 10 feet away. Mrs. Beasley looked at these admirable footprints with neither awe nor interest, only annoyance at the thought of her husband's triumph and the vindication of the Portuguese. She did not cry out in wonder, or call to the sleeping menfolk, but only gave a sort of honking snort. Then, picking up a sizable palm frond, this unscrupulous woman obliterated the highly interesting footprints never before seen by a white person's eyes. Having done so, she smiled grimly and looked for the next, and she wiped that one too. A little farther on, she saw another, and then still one more, and so on,
till she had removed every trace down to the tepid lip of the lake, where the last was printed at the very edge of the water. Having obliterated this final trace, Mrs. Beasley straightened up and looked back toward the hut.
"You shall hear of this," she said,
addressing her sleeping husband,
"when we are settled down at Miami, and you are too old to do anything about it."
At that moment, there was a swirl in the water behind her, and she was seized by a set of teeth which quite exactly resembled sabers. She had no leisure to check up on the other points mentioned by the Portuguese doctor, but no doubt they came up to specification. She uttered one brief scream as she disappeared, but her voice was hoarse by reason of the strain she had put on it during the previous weeks. And her cry, even if it had been heard, could easily have been confused with the mating call of the Megatherium, thought to be extinct. In fact, the last surviving Megatherium emerged from the jungle only shortly afterward, looked around in all directions, shrugged his shoulders resignedly, and went back the way he had come. Shortly afterward, Mr. Beasley awoke, noted the absence of his wife, and finally went and woke the Portuguese.
"Have you seen my wife?" said he.
"Really?"
said the little Portuguese, and went to sleep again. Mr. Beasley went out and looked around, and at last returned to his friend.
"I'm afraid my wife has run away," said he. "I found her footprints leading down to the lake, where she has evidently encountered some native in a canoe, and persuaded him to transport her down the river. She was always threatening to do so in order to take a small house at Miami."
"That is not a bad town," said the Portuguese. "But in the circumstances, perhaps Buenos Aires is better. This monster is a great disappointment, my dear friend. Let us go back to Buenos Aires, where I will show you some extraordinary things. In quite a different line, of course, such as your Ripley has never dreamed of."
"What an agreeable companion you are," said Mr. Beasley. "You make even city life sound attractive."
"Well, if you get tired of it, we can always move on," said the little Portuguese. "I know some tropical islands where the girls, though their lips are not designed to hold dinner plates, are nevertheless marvels of nature, and their dances are wonders of art."
That was Incident on a Lake by John Collier, read by Mary Murphy. In the story you just heard, you may have noticed the name Ripley referenced several times, as well as remarks about certain native women having elongated lips, quote, "big enough to have dinner plates set in them." Well, if you haven't guessed already, Ripley refers to none other than Robert L. Ripley, the creator of Ripley's Believe It or Not, whose wild stories and weird factoids we here at Fireside Mystery Theater have quite a bit of affection for. Since John Collier brought it up in his story, here's the actual snippet culled directly from Robert Ripley's first Believe It or Not book, published by Simon & Schuster in 1929. Again, here's Mary Murphy.
Hot lips. Beauty is, of course, a matter of personal opinion. But surely nowhere in the world do people hold stranger opinions than the Saras Jingis in Africa. The distorted lips of these Central Africa belles are one of the most astonishing customs in the world. Their lips are pierced with wooden discs of increasing size, until the lower lip is distended to such an extent that 14-inch soup plates can be worn. The enormous overgrowth of lips makes the chewing of food impossible, so these women must live almost entirely upon a liquid diet. Speech is nearly impossible, and so difficult that they do not make anything but the most necessary splutters. When a girl is about 4 years old, her future husband makes a hole in the center of her upper and lower lips with a rough knife, and small pegs of wood are placed within. Gradually, the size of the wooden pegs are increased until by the time she has reached womanhood, her lips are things of beauty and a joy forever. At night, the Genghis wife sleeps with her huge lower lip on her husband's shoulder. This enables him to feel that his wife is with him, that she has not been stolen or run away from him in the darkness.
If you haven't already, we highly recommend that you listen to our little homage to Robert Ripley and Ripley's Believe It or Not. He features in one of our favorite radio plays, Pearl Roth. Look for episode 29.3 in our podcast feed. Tonight's author, John Collier, once remarked self-effacingly, "I sometimes marvel that a third-rate writer like me has been able to palm himself off as a second-rate writer." Collier may have had something of a lower profile than better-known authors of the time, such as Ray Bradbury, Roald Dahl, or Anthony Burgess, but even literary greats such as these were all fans of Collier's work, particularly for his subtle skills as a craftsman of odd fantasies that boast a style uniquely their own. The London-born Collier quietly made his mark in the UK and in America as a successful writer of short stories and screenplays. Several of his best pieces of fiction were adapted for film and television. Both Alfred Hitchcock and Rod Serling adapted his twisted tales for their respective television series. He also won 2 Edgar Awards for his remarkable contributions to dark literature. Collier's stories often appear in many collections of suspense or supernatural fiction, but we strongly recommend picking up a copy of his Fancies and Goodnights, which is still in print today. There you will find superb and deftly crafted tales such as Evening Primrose, Back for Christmas, Thus I Refute Bealsy, Lady on the Grey, and many other tales guaranteed to stir those parts of your imagination that could use a good poke or two. The Midnight Reading is produced by Gustavo Rodriguez and me for Fireside Mystery Productions. Our audio engineer is Wayne Silver, and our series was recorded at the Ice Plant Studio in New York City. I edited and supervised post-production. This summer's collection was curated and our series written by Sylvan Sandovar. Our theme music is by Martina Da Silva. Be sure not to miss any installment of The Midnight Reading by subscribing to the Fireside Mystery Theater podcast feed on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. A rating and review on iTunes would be most valued and appreciated. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @FiresideMystery. You can further support our passion for creating deliciously dark audio entertainment by becoming an FMT Patreon patron. Visit patreon.com/firesidemysterytheater for details. And for those of you in the New York City area, mark your calendars. Fireside Mystery Theater returns to the stage for a brand new season of thrilling and chilling original audio drama on Sunday, October 21st, 2018 at 5 p.m. We've got an exciting new season of The Strange and Mysterious lined up for you at the Slipper Room in New York City. Tickets are on sale at slipperroom.com. This is Ali Silva, strongly encouraging you to explore and discover the bewitching appeal of dark literature at your local bookstore or library. Thank you, kind listeners, for joining us. And until next time, be sure to mind the shadows.